This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's great to be here with you. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news. With our panel here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Thanks for having me.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is embroiled in a major legal battle right now, and the timing is bad, not only because it's happening with just 1 month to go before fresh elections in Israel, but also because this internal political battle is taking place just as the nation is facing several very troubling crises as well. To tell us about this, we'll turn to Brent.
We have been focusing on internal politics a little bit over the past couple of weeks on this program, just because Mr. Netanyahu has been seen and really has been a very strong leader in terms of protecting Israel from outside threats. And he is going to face the toughest election that he has, I would say, in the past 10 years in one month's time. And yet we have converging crises that are threatening to, or that are putting him in a very tough position going forward. The best way for him going forward would be that there is no serious dust-ups with the Palestinians for the next month. And people would see that as generally a tick for Mr. Netanyahu at being able to keep them safe. His policies working with the Palestinians, and so they might elect him again. Well, you have these three areas of a dangerous threat right now. That threat is increasing: the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and this threat on the Temple Mount that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. The one on the Temple Mount is the worst one. This is where you have this standoff that continues even to this day, of Palestinians that are trying to access an area that was long since closed by Israel on the Temple Mount. They want to create a mosque in this area on the Temple Mount. They already have four mosques on the Temple Mount. Now they want a fifth one. They need this fifth one there. And Israel wants to shut it down and not allow them to do that. And the Palestinians have been calling now for mass protests until Israel backs down. And so there were thousands upon thousands of Palestinians on the Temple Mount this week. It did just today. It didn't get violent today. A couple of reporters were in the Old City saying that it was extremely tense, but there was police absolutely everywhere to ensure that nothing got out of hand. However, it still may get out of hand because we have, even over the weekend on Sunday, the King of Jordan is flying over to the United States to try and discuss what they can do about this Temple Mount impasse with the president and probably some Israelis over there. Jordan, of course, it runs the day-to-day affairs on the Temple Mount, even though it's in Israeli sovereign territory. So this is really the motivating force that could threaten to really set ablaze the Palestinians on the West Bank, or inside the West Bank, and on the Gaza Strip.
So it almost seems the Palestinians really have an excellent sense of timing here. Israel, as preoccupied as it is with its own internal affairs, Netanyahu trying to fight for his political survival, this is the time when they're ramping up the pressure on Israel. You mentioned those other two fronts, I guess, of alarm against Israel, Gaza and the West Bank. Maybe you could talk about those.
Yeah, this week we saw an uptick of violence. There was numerous explosive balloons that were sent over the border. They basically fly over, then land in Jewish communities and explode and hopefully kill somebody. They were sent over. There was a rocket that was sent over as well. While that doesn't sound like much, there hadn't been much in the past month or so. And so Israelis were worried about this. They sent in Egyptian mediators to talk to Hamas and said, hey, you better back down, a bit of stop that, or Israel's going to have to come in hard. And Hamas said they're not going to stop anything. So there's that. issue that's kind of bubbling away right now. And then there was another terrorist attack in the West Bank. We don't really talk about these that often, but they happen all the time. There were 138 terrorist attacks in November, 138 in December, 118 in October, and then going back to September, there was just in September, I guess it was a little bit less than that. So we are seeing a ramping up of terrorist attacks, Hamas-led terrorist attacks in the West Bank. The latest one was pretty startling, and one that is, this took place on Monday, is very unusual. You had these three terrorists that were going to firebomb one of the main highways, an army checkpoint, and then for whatever reason, that didn't work out. And so on the way back, from that unsuccessful terrorist attack, they saw a broken down military vehicle and two officers trying to fix that. And so they decide, three of them, to run them over in their car. Normally, when you have one of these rammings, it's just one person driving the vehicle, acting kind of on impulse. But this shows that, you know, they're willing to have a fight. They're willing to even go in with three, because three people's a waste, because they're probably going to be killed. And so they would rather do that with one. But they're just so ready. They're so ready to, many of them, to commit these terrorist acts that Israel is worried. The army said this week that every day that goes by where there isn't an uprising, a full-fledged uprising in the West Bank, is a happy day. Wow. That's how close it is from being set ablaze. And again, by themselves, these smaller terrorist attacks in those two territories might not seem like much, but when you have the match that could really light those two arenas getting ready to be struck on the Temple Mount, this is something that we need to take a close look at.
And Brent, just briefly, as you're watching Israel prepare for these elections and you're seeing the kind of pressure that Netanyahu is under right now, what are you watching for? How do you foresee this playing out?
Well, I foresee the Palestinians getting exactly what they want on the Temple Mount. I don't, at least in the near term, Mr. Netanyahu can't afford to cause a major dust up there, because that is going to spread. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is a temporary allowance of Palestinians to pray in this area, or perhaps they want to renovate it. So maybe they allow them to renovate it, and then we'll talk about it later. He's got to preserve calm for the next month, or he's probably out. Now, already it seems like, as I said, he's going to face the toughest election. It's possible, if elections were held today, that no coalition would maybe be able to form a government. And so for the first time in Israel's history, you would have to have another election following that up. That's how bitterly divided the nation is right now, in a way that it hasn't been before. I believe, I'm not a total expert on Israeli internal historical politics, but you have the main opposition basically saying, if people vote for Netanyahu, our democracy is dead. Everything's all over. We're going to have a corrupt leader. Mm-hmm. And so if people, it's not just a popularity contest between two leaders with different policies now. Now it's a moral issue that is being created by electing Netanyahu as prime minister. And so if that happens, I think Israel's democracy itself, or just the nation, will be extremely fractured, and that it will not be the type of situation that is best for them to try and face the threats that they will face with this Palestinian uprising. So in the short term, this might blow over, but in the long term, we know that Bible prophecy definitely does put the Temple Mount in a very important location as the trigger that forces Israel to respond to Palestinian actions on the Temple Mount, but then will spread into the West Bank, and the Palestinians will rise up to take half of the city. The Bible is very clear about that, and people can read up on that by requesting our editor-in-chief's book, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
And in addition to that, Brent has an article on thetrumpet.com, In Shadow of Elections, Crises Converge on Israel. You can check that out with more information on some of the specifics that he was describing in that report. And you can find that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that very much, Brent. Over to Asia now for the next couple of stories. You're likely aware of the trade war roiling between the United States and China. This has caused major disruptions for many businesses, but some analysts recognize this conflict also benefits others. To tell us who they are, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, for the past couple months, President Trump and President Xi Jinping in China have been at least verbally hoping to de-escalate the trade war that the two nations are in, with each nation raising the tariffs on the other nation's goods. They were hoping to come up with some sort of deal by March 2nd, which didn't happen. Now they're pushing it back by up to March 27th to come up with something where both sides reduce the tariffs. I don't think many people are optimistic. The Chinese economy is based on selling cheap goods to America, for which America ramps up a big trade deficit to pay for. So they're not going to want to de-escalate their trade war. They want to keep their current practices going. The Trump administration's against it. But as you mentioned, there actually could be some winners in this situation. A new study was published February 4th by the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, pointing out the obvious fact that when Americans put tariffs on Chinese goods, it makes Americans less likely to buy Chinese goods. And when the Chinese put tariffs on American goods, it makes the Chinese less likely to buy American goods. So the question comes, well, where are they going to buy these goods? They can produce them domestically, which Mr. Trump is hoping for on America's part. Or they can buy from a new trade partner. And this study shows that the European Union, Mexico, and Japan may be the big winners as both China and the United States try to buy goods from them instead that they can't get from each other, or that they don't want to get from each other because of these rising tariffs.
Okay. So the European Union, Mexico, and Japan.
Japan, yes.
Are the winners.
Seem to be, yeah. The study brings up the fact that they think the European Union may get a $70 billion boost in exports, roughly half to the United States, half to China. Whereas
that's a massive boost.
It is a big boost. Plus Mexico, Japan, and they even throw Canada in here, may all get a $20 billion boost in exports. And so these are powers that are... economies could see an upturn as their people start manufacturing new goods to sell to the United States and China, as the United States and China continue to have this falling out.
So you're looking at this in light of Bible prophecy. It is interesting of all of those beneficiaries that you're describing. The European Union makes out at the top of the list as the biggest beneficiary.
Right, and that's we've mentioned many times on this program before specific prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 about a mart of nations that trades with each other, but not with the United States. It's basically like an economic siege against the United States, and the leading figures in that mart of nation are Tyre and Kittim, which our editor-in-chief, Mr. Joe Flurry, explains in his book Isaiah's End Time Vision, that Tyre and Kittim are prophetic names for the modern resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, Europe, and China. And so the fact that Europe and China are trading more with each other in response to America and China having a falling out is extremely prophetic. Now, I guess Europe and America are also trading a little more together as a result of this trade war, which is something that the Bible indicates is going to change. But and it even mentions, we'll have an article put in the show note, Trade Wars Have Begun, that even highlights another prophecy in Revelation 18 that talks about these merchants of the earth, that they will wax rich through trading delicacies, but that at Christ's return they'll weep and howl because no one buys their goods anymore. That's a New Testament parallel to that same Old Testament prophecy, which that article on Trade Wars Have Begun explains, showing that you've got this mart of nations, these merchants of the earth, this huge trading conglomerate in the end time that that trades all around the world, except with the United States. And so now the fact that this trade war is showing that America is trading less with China, and that's prompting China to trade more with Europe, it's just a slow, that UN study calls it a distortion of the trade markets, where markets are shifting from China-Europe. Now, right now that distortion's slow. Bible prophecy indicates there's going to be, at some point in the near future, a more dramatic break where America is just frozen out of world trade,
mm-hmm.
as these trade war it's currently in push it to other markets. And this is something we've been saying for years. Mr. Armstrong, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor of The Plain Truth, it's our predecessor organization, wrote all the way back in 1971 that either we start raising high tariff barriers against other countries, starting a trade war that will in time trigger the nuclear war that will destroy us, or American workers are going to have to meet the competition of workers in other countries by lowering standards of living. Obviously, the Americans do not want to work for Chinese standards of living. and that's why President Trump is raising these tariffs. But as Mr. Armstrong said all the way back in the 70s, these tariffs are going to start a trade war that will eventually force nations make nations choose to stop trading with America. And then there are other prophecies that even have to show that escalating into a hot war, as trade wars often do.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is interesting to watch the relationship develop between China and Europe. We know prophecy shows eventually that relationship is going to turn into a war as well. But in the short term, the two band together in order to undercut the United States and to see the fallout from the trade war that's developed between the United States and China actually drive China and Europe into each other's arms to a greater degree. It is quite extraordinary to see that happen. Well, we will put that article, Trade Wars Have Begun, in the show notes for this particular segment. And we certainly appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. There is still more evidence emerging of China taking over the waters around the Philippines. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Chinese fishing fleets have asserted control over it's a whole string of sandbars near the Philippines' Pagasa Island, there in the Spratly Islands, which is in the South China Sea. So this is an area that's within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. That's an area based on international law, which says a country's territorial borders extend 200 nautical miles from its coasts. And the law says that any natural resources found within a country's exclusive economic zone belong exclusively to that nation. So most countries go by this to determine their maritime boundaries, but China is the big exception, especially when it comes to the waters in the South China Sea area. China asserts control, well, they claim to exclusively own pretty much that entire very vast region. And in recent years, they've been, you know, just really asserting more and more control over parts of the region there. And now the Chinese have set their sights on these sandbars in a very fish-rich part of the Spratly Islands. Roberto Del Mundo is mayor of the Philippine town of Calayayan, which administers Pagasa Island. And he talked to the Philippine media about this on Monday, and he said, quote, "When our fishermen are about to get near sandbar number 3, that's the sandbar closest to Pagasa, then a Chinese fishing vessel will immediately come up to us and ward us off so that we can't come closer," end quote. So the Chinese fishing fleets have sort of, you know, established a presence there, and they're kind of boxing out the Philippine fishermen in this area, which belongs to the Philippines. And Mr. Del Mundo said that the Chinese have also recently been flying helicopters over Pagasa Island itself, which is a, you know, it's a populated island. Philippine people have lived there for, I think it's since 1978. There've been a couple of hundred people living there. But China is really just showing itself, as you said, to be more and more aggressive in this area.
So could you put this in context of the kinds of, first of all, we've been talking about the relationship that has developed between the Philippines and China. We were talking about that with Nikolai Giliar on the program just a week or so ago. And the fact that Rodrigo Duterte, the Philippine president, is reorienting his foreign policy away from the United States and toward China. Mm-hmm. China, we've obviously been talking about how much it's been asserting its presence in that whole area at the Philippines' expense. So there's this sort of tension between these two at the same time that there's a reconciliation happening between the two. Right. Maybe you could just help to contextualize this for us.
Sure. Yeah, I think if it were up to Rodrigo Duterte, the Philippine president, the Philippines would be very closely aligned with China and possibly bring an end to its U.S. alliance. You know, like many presidents, he's not as powerful as he perhaps would want to be. And so the top brass there in the Philippine military and many of the other legislators prevent that from happening. And actually, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled to the Philippines just on Friday. And, he, you know, before this visit, America has always refrained from saying that its mutual defense treaty with the Philippines covers the South China Sea islands. Mm. We've always said, yes, if the Philippines itself is attacked, of course we would come to your defense. But we have, for decades, we've refrained from saying whether that treaty would be invoked if one of these scattered islands were attacked by China. But during this visit, though, Pompeo held a joint press conference with the Philippine Secretary of Foreign Affairs, and he announced that any armed attack on Philippine forces, aircraft, or public vessels in the South China Sea will trigger mutual defense obligations under Article 4 Wow. of our mutual defense treaty. So it signals quite a higher level of commitment from the United States to the Philippines. And it's something that the Philippines has wanted America to clarify and to publicly state for years, and now it's finally been stated.
Otherwise, they really don't have much of a defense against these kinds of aggressive moves by China.
Exactly, and you can see why the Philippines has always been reluctant to stand up to China in the South China Sea,
right?
Because if they've said, we don't even know if America would have our back,
right,
of course it would just be not logical to challenge a far more powerful nation like that. So this would have deeply angered China, of course, to hear that America is kind of expanding its, or at least clarifying that its treaty does, in fact, cover the Philippines' claims. However, Geopolitical Futures said that even though this announcement does represent a big step forward for the Philippine-U.S. alliance, there are still holes in Pompeo's interpretation wide enough to steer a frigate through. Uh-huh. So, you know, we don't expect this to change the overall trend of in the South China Sea, of the U.S. growing weaker and of China controlling more and more of the area.
Huh. I'm just kind of dumbstruck by that statement by Mike Pompeo. You know, for the United States to be extending its commitment to the Philippines and to holding the line against China's incursion into that area, to the degree that his words imply, it seems like the United States, it's hard to foresee the United States actually taking the steps that would be necessary to back those words up. As much as you know, Filipinos may listen to that and say, wow, it's really nice to hear an American leader standing up and saying that, you know, translating that into action, it's hard to foresee the American administration actually following that up.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. It's it was a bold statement, and I'm sure that it was welcomed by the Philippines to, you know, I'm sure they were really excited to hear about that. But in the end, it is just a statement. And we have seen the U.S. Continuing to conduct freedom of navigation operations. And recently, even the UK and France and Australia and a few other nations have started to help America just sort of patrol through these islands and through these spaces that China claims. More and more nations are saying, we refuse to admit that you control this area. So there are some actions, but I think that with China, this is an existential threat for them to,
right,
to see that the South China Sea could be, you know, blockaded. If they can't import and export right there, they would be in serious trouble. And for all these other nations, it's just kind of nice to have sea lanes that we can ship things through. And there would always be alternative lanes that are slightly longer. So I think that, you know, China would actually go to war to preserve their dominance of this area, whereas the other nations, including the U.S., I don't think that we would be willing to. If the U.S. would use all of its power, we could probably, you know, still dominate that area, even though China's entrenched. But I just don't think that we would be willing to.
Right.
And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that the fact that China is controlling more and more of the South China Sea should alarm the world, because it means China is, well, he used this quote, steering the world toward war. He wrote an article in the July 2016 print edition by that title, China is Steering the World Toward War. And one part of that article points out that this is all happening in a region that the United States has had naval dominance over for some 70 years now. And he says that China is now challenging those 7 decades of America's stabilizing dominance over this area. And so that should alarm the world. And Mr. Fleury's article from there just explains that all of China's provocative activity in this area is contributing to the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about modern-day America and Britain losing control of the oceanic gates and vital shipping routes that they long controlled. That's a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52. And Mr. Fleury says China's takeover of the South China Sea is one of many areas where onlookers today can, quote, already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment. So it is definitely a hot spot that we should stay closely focused on, because we see this prophecy being fulfilled there.
Well, we'll put a link to that article in the show notes for today's program, China is Steering the World Toward War. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Over to Europe now, France's president. He's not too popular among his people, but that isn't stopping him from continuing to try to promote himself as the visionary new leader for all of Europe. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, French President Emmanuel Macron wrote an article to the entire population of Europe, had it published in a newspaper in just about every different language across the whole continent. And I'll just read the beginning of this article, because I think it helps you understand the tenor of what he's saying there. He says, I am taking the liberty of addressing you directly. It is not only in the name of the history and values that unite us, it is because time is of the essence. In a few weeks' time, the European elections will be decisive for the future of the continent. Never since the Second World War has Europe been as essential, yet never has Europe been in so much danger. So it's an urgent appeal to European citizens, basically for more Europe. He calls for, basically he says, 3 ambitions, freedom, protection, and progress. And one of the big parts of that is protection. He talks about having a common border force for Europe, common borders, a new treaty on security and defense. He even, he basically calls for a new summit to kind of have new treaties that radically change how Europe works. So, you know, some dramatic calls there to all of Europe. And it's because of the European elections that are coming up in May. And I think sometimes when the EU leaders do this, it can be easy to dismiss them and say, well, yes, they're always calling for more Europe. But I think that's kind of the point. They're always calling for more Europe. It doesn't matter what the question is. The answer is always more Europe.
Yeah.
And if you look at what Europe's been through over the last just a little bit, with Britain on the brink of leaving the European Union, hopefully March 29th, with the European elections coming up and with anti-EU parties taking over governments across the continent, with these anti-EU parties poised to become one of the largest blocs in the EU Parliament, if not the largest bloc in the European Parliament coming up in May, you would have think this would be a time for European leaders to maybe take a step back a bit. And think, or write an article that says, okay, you know, we've heard your concern.
Right.
We've seen that more Europe is unpopular across the continent. We've seen that you guys don't like this idea of having a European defense force, of handing over national powers to the European Union. we understand that, we'll scale back, we'll step back, we'll put things on pause.
Right.
When instead, what you get is the exact opposite. Emmanuel Macron saying, we urgently need to put our foot down and we need to zoom ahead for more Europe in all of these areas and make big and radical changes. It's a religion. They're just committed to that no matter what else is happening in the world.
Well, this, in some ways, it feels like somewhat of a caricature of a certain type of European thinker. And at the same time, you have these other European leaders, Viktor Orban and others, who seem to have more of that, more of their finger on the pulse of what's happening among the populations of Europe, who are expressing the kinds of concerns that you're talking about. Watching this play out, these different sort of strands of leadership within Europe and trying to find, forge a common future, it's quite a fascinating process to witness. But it is interesting that here Macron in France is kind of taking them on so much down the road of this is the way that we've done this in the face of what you see happening in so many of these other countries.
Yes, it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, exactly how this plays out. There are different people pushing for different visions of Europe in different directions. I think one of the things that comes out from what he's pushing for that others across the EU have also talked about is this push to move Europe away from unanimity, away from having to have 28 member states agree on everything before it happens, and trying to have something that can make decisions much more quickly, potentially even a smaller group of nations. The German Manfred Weber, who he's running as president of the European Commission, which would be a big post, at least a symbolic post on the European scene. He's talked about this and kind of taken some of Macron's comments and pushed them in this direction of saying, well, we need to get rid of this unanimity. We potentially need a smaller, leaner group of nations that can more closely integrate. Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg has talked about some of this, and even people like Germany's Wolfgang Schäuble. So you are seeing, even from a range of different areas, this idea that Europe needs to be smaller but much more unified. And this is ultimately the direction that the Bible says that it's going to take. There were very clear prophecies and things like Revelation chapter 17 that talks about Europe being this 10-nation superpower where you have 10 kings, they work closely together, they give their strength and power to the beast. They're giving up their, they're working together and they're giving up their power, or they're working together militarily with this overall empire. That's where Europe is going. And so you see European leaders in all their, in maybe their different ways with their slightly different visions, but that's the direction they're all pushing Europe into.
Yeah, we appreciate that very much, Richard. Well, we will put a link in the show notes to Who and What is the Prophetic Beast. This is the booklet that Herbert W. Armstrong put together explaining these prophecies that spell out how Europe's future is going to unfold. We also have a trend on thetrumpet.com, Europe becoming a 10-nation superpower. There are definitely major political changes ahead in the time very soon in Europe's future. And as these leaders are discussing these ideas, we know that there are going to forcibly emerge some that make a huge difference in the way that Europe is governing itself very soon. So thank you very much for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll talk about unintended effects of the collapse of nuclear talks between Donald Trump and North Korea, a man who works in the shadows to implement Iran's pushy foreign policy, Britain's knife crime epidemic, and billionaires prepping for the end of the world. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Donald Trump's visit to Vietnam to meet with North Korea's Kim Jong-un did not end with the deal that he was hoping for. The question is, what will happen next? For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, as you said, President Trump returned empty-handed from those talks in Hanoi, Vietnam. Andrew spoke about that on the show last week. So those talks collapsed. And in the time since then, new satellite images have been published showing that North Korea is now suddenly rebuilding one of its main illegal weapons testing sites. So this looks like a big blow for those peace efforts that looked quite promising even just, you know, a few months ago. And there are many nations that this has big implications for, but probably the one that we should be watching the most closely in this dynamic is Japan. George Friedman wrote about this on Tuesday. I'll just read a little bit of his analysis here. He said, "The major question that has emerged from the Hanoi talks is what Japan will do now. Japan is the world's third largest economy. It has a stable and homogenous population, a substantial military force, and an enormous capacity to increase that force." And then Friedman goes on to explain that the U.S. seems to be okay with North Korea being a nuclear power as long as its weapons can't reach the U.S. mainland. But that, you know, implicit in that position is that the United States can tolerate a nuclear North Korea that can threaten Japan. So it really destabilizes Japan's entire post-World War II strategy of relying on the U.S. And Friedman talks about how there's a lack of trust now from Japan toward the U.S. and how this will just prompt the Japanese to work toward becoming a full-fledged normalized military power once again. And really, Japan's return to militarization aligns with Bible prophecy and with what Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about how Japan fits into Bible prophecy. All the way back in 1934, the very first issue of his Plain Truth magazine, Mr. Armstrong mentioned Japan being aligned with Russia. And then in the April 68 issue, quote here says, "Asia will ultimately be welded together into a common power block. This prophecy is recorded in Revelation 16, 12 and 16. Japan will play a vital role in this battle." So a very powerful quote there. And these are just a few of the statements showing how Bible prophecy says Japan, or how Mr. Armstrong was explaining that Bible prophecy said that Japan would remilitarize in the end time. And now we see that happening largely because of the North Korean nuclear threat and the United States' failure to contain that threat, at least in a way that would help Japan. So we have a lot of these statements from Mr. Armstrong gathered up in our booklet, He Was Right. There's a whole chapter in there called The Land of the Rising Sun about Japan's role in Bible prophecy.
Wow, quite extraordinary to see that unfolding according to those prophecies in light of the United States trying to negotiate its way to a peaceful solution over there, but the way that that's affecting the region as a whole is quite interesting. We appreciate that very much, Jeremiah. Well, Iran's foreign policy flows from its supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, and its most prominent public face is its president, Hassan Rouhani. But there's another man who works considerably more in the shadows, yet whose influence has been growing steadily for several years now. To learn about him, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
We often speak about Qassem Soleimani. He's the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, Quds Force. We talk about him because he is extremely active outside of Iran in foreign nations, directing Iran's military, basically, its military maneuvers, its policy. He's a very powerful individual. And events over the past couple of weeks make it seem as though he's gaining more and more power inside the revolution, working for the revolution. He reports directly to the Ayatollah himself, and he has access to funds directly from the Ayatollah. So he has not much red tape to go through whatsoever. And it seems like he is rising at the same time that we are seeing the fall of one of the more public faces of the Iranian regime, that is Javad Zarif. He is the foreign minister. He's the one that negotiated the nuclear deal with the West, with the United States. He's the one that was pulling for that. He was most recently was at the Munich Security Conference, where he got rather heated talking about the United States and how wicked the United States is, and the fact that Europe is going along with the United States and they just stand up to the United States. And upon his return from the Munich Security Conference, Javad Zarif, there was an important meeting that took place in Tehran. This is when the Syrian president, that is in a relationship with Iran that exists basically because of Iran's support in the civil war in Syria, Bashar al-Assad, he made this visit to Tehran. And yet the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, who you would think would be very much up to speed with the head of state of another country coming to into Iran, he wasn't even aware that the president of Syria was there. And so promptly after this meeting that he was not a part of took place, he handed in his resignation. He decided that I'm done. I can't, you know, support what's going on, or at least I don't have power to affect change because I feel like I'm losing that power, and so I'm done. Now, he has come back and said, okay, fine, I'll be the foreign minister still. But in response to that, we had Qassem Soleimani, who was in on that meeting, who in fact did arrange for the Syrian president to fly into Tehran and to meet with the Ayatollah and Soleimani himself. He tried to cover up this and wrote a letter to the public saying, hey, this was just a mistake. We should, with the bureaucracy here, you know, got in the way. We forgot to tell the foreign ministry office that we had a head of state come into town. And so what's important in this situation is that we have a rise of the other side of Iran's, let's say, their political maneuverings outside the nation. You have the violent side, the warlike side that's led by Soleimani, that is taking over territory, fighting for Iran's interest. And you have the soft power side that's led by Zarif. And it seems that Zarif's power is plummeting. He's not able to do what he wants. And yet at the same time, that is kind of being replaced by Soleimani.
Well, tell us more about Soleimani and just what you kind of alluded to it there, the implications of his rise to power really entails.
Right. So Soleimani is quite an incredible individual. He, as I said, he leads the Quds force, and this is the force that is extremely effective, the most effective paramilitary force in the world, I would call it. Well, it's basically a military force, but it acts like a militia. Whenever you have Iranian interests being furthered through the use of a proxy, whether it be Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, the mastermind behind that is Soleimani. He is on the battlefield directing things. People love him. Love him in Iran. Right, now
he's Rouhani really built quite a track record of success over the last several years in several
successes.
Different theaters.
I mean, yeah. he basically formed this the head of the Quds force, or part of the head of the Quds force, back in 98. He's been active in Iraq. He was the creator of a lot of led the offensive with all the IEDs, the improvised explosive devices that were blowing up the Americans in Iraq. He was behind that push. He's the one that's over in Iraq over the past couple of past year trying to negotiate with Iraqi parliamentarians who's going to be in power. He's the one that flies up in 2015 to Moscow to talk to President Putin and says, please come down and help out in Syria. We need your help. And he's got 70% popularity back home in Iran when Rouhani has about 30%, the president of the country. Hmm. And so everyday Iranians see this man as an effective general. He's a soft-spoken man, but he gets things done. Now, over the past year, we have seen him come out more. He has gone toe-to-toe with the president on Twitter, even saying that we're ready for you, Mr. Trump. You might strike first, but we'll strike last. He's been extremely vocal against the Israelis of late. And he wasn't like this a decade ago. He wasn't like this even 5 years ago, but we're seeing him become more vocal. Now, it looks like there is more power going to him, or being given to him. He's been given more keys of power of foreign policy by the Ayatollah. And Bible prophecy indicates that Iran is going to have a foreign policy that is follows the ilk, I guess, of how he works. It is a more aggressive force. The use of soft power to achieve their aims is only going to go so far. And that's why you see him, Rouhani losing power now, Zarif losing power right now. The Ayatollah and a lot of the other hardliners, as they're called, are wondering whether the nuclear deal is even benefiting us anymore, since Europe's being so slow to help out, according to them. And so we can't see this as a contest between people that love the Iranian regime, people that hate the Iranian regime. Zarif, Rouhani, though they're painted as moderates, they still believe in the Iranian regime. They just believe that soft power will further their aims. Well, you have Soleimani, you have the Ayatollah himself, you even have the new judiciary head that was made the head of their judiciary this week, who's a hardliner. They believe that getting together with the West and rapprochement with the West is not the way to further Iran's ambitions.
Yeah.
And so biblical prophecy indicates that we are going to see Iran turn more offensive militarily and to further their objectives that way. And when we see their foreign minister that doesn't believe in that, that's the way to do it, fall, and Soleimani rise, we're getting closer to those prophecies being more fully fulfilled.
Well, that is very interesting, just looking at the internal machinations of the Iranian regime and seeing this political shift, somewhat of a power shift within the government there, and this very effective general receiving the kind of confidence that he is from the Ayatollah at the expense of some of these other more politically minded individuals. It does definitely bring to mind those prophecies of the Iranian pushy foreign policy, as Gerald Flory brings out in that King of the South booklet. You can look at that on thetrumpet.com. That's available in our literature library, The King of the South, that puts all of that in a prophetic context. We appreciate that very much, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Thank you for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. In the UK, there is an alarming trend unfolding on the streets in recent years. To tell us about it, we'll go back to our office in the UK and Richard Palmer.
Yes, knife crime has been all over the news in the UK this week. The epidemic is being called a national crisis. There was a very senior police officer who talked about how the government, he talked about whether the government should declare a state of emergency over it. Another head of a police force talked about potentially even calling the army in to deal with the problem. One of the things that catapulted this subject into the news was some statistics released by the National Health Service that showed that treatment for stab wounds among 16-year-olds and younger in Britain has basically almost doubled since 2013. And there's just a whole host of stats that show that this problem is just exploding. You know, homicides by knife crimes are at their highest level at least since 1977, and that's probably older even still. Hospital admissions are higher than at any time over the last 9-10 years or so. Offenses involving a knife or sharp instrument are the highest for several years, again, if not a record. So you're seeing all of these massive figures just over the last week or two as well. There have been some high-profile murders, some of them not all that far from where we are near Stratford-upon-Avon. There have been in Birmingham some stabbings. You have stats showing that this is going on all the time in London. So it's something that's becoming a major problem over here.
That is really ghastly. Stephen Flory has been talking about that on the Trumpet Daily radio show. Maybe you could just give us sort of a rundown of how he's covering this, just in light of the prophecies of the Bible.
Yeah, so he covered that on the show on March 6th. It's about 15 minutes into the program if you want to listen to it. And you know, it is a subject where the Bible has a lot to say about just the entire breakdown of society, a failure on so many levels. I think it's a problem where, you know, people are talking about all kinds of things to try and solve it, but there isn't a simple government-run solution. You know, people are saying, "Oh, we need to stop expelling people from schools," and you know, but that doesn't solve the problem.
Right.
People are saying, "Well, maybe we need to try and ban knives more."
Right.
Well, that's not going to solve the problem. People are talking about stop and search, which that could help, having the police stop people, search them more. That was suspended because people said it was racist. But at the end of the day, you know, what are the causes of this kind of thing? It's things like family breakdowns. It's breakdowns in society. It's people you know, it's these rising gangs and rising crises, and that's hard for the government to fix. I think a great place to go to read more about this is an article Jeremiah had in The Trumpet a couple of years ago called Land of the Free, Home of the 33,000 Violent Street Gangs. I mean, it's about a similar, very similar problem in the United States. But everything that he says, all of his analysis in there, really applies. And he goes through how exactly this kind of general societal breakdown is prophesied in the Bible. But then he also concludes and shows how that this is going to be fixed as well, that God has a solution for this. And, you know, yes, there's no simple government solution, but there's God's law. And ultimately, when people are obeying that again, that is going to lead to a time where we no longer have to worry about this youth knife crime epidemic.
Yeah, well, we'll put a link to those in the show notes, that article by Jeremiah Jacques. How about that? Richard, giving you a little bit of love there, Jeremiah. Yeah. And the March 6th Trumpet Daily Radio Show segment on that subject for more information about that. Thank you, Richard. Well, are we living in the end time? There's a contingent of people who believe so, and they're taking some pretty expensive steps to prepare for it. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, a growing number of Americans are preparing for social and economic collapse. I mean, we probably all have or know someone who has that crazy survivalist uncle hoarding food and ammunition in the woods.
I don't have one of those, Andrew.
The less I say about that, the better. But but this is actually starting to go more mainstream with even like biomedical engineers and billionaires from Silicon Valley getting in on the game. It was an article in ABC News talking about how the owner of the Vivo Group, it's a group that builds bunkers for end-of-the-world scenarios, is getting a lot of business. He said he's built three bunker communities in the United States in the past 10 years for middle-class preppers, and one in a secret location for the ultra-wealthy. His quote, the owner's quote, was, says, "Our locations can hold up to 10,000 like-minded people all carrying guns in the area three-quarters the size of Manhattan. Wow. They become their own army because that's the nature of survival." And then there's another group that had estimated that actually half of the tech billionaires in Silicon Valley are taking preparations for the end of the world. And so this isn't like just some crackpot conspiracy by that survivalist uncle I won't mention. But this is actually like half of the people who are smart enough to make $1 billion in Silicon Valley are taking this seriously, that you could have a World War III economic collapse scenario that you have to prepare for, which goes right along with what the prophecies of the Bible. I don't know how many of them are actually believing the prophecies of the Bible. Probably not many, as I'll point out in a moment, because Jesus Christ himself said in Luke 21:36 that watch you therefore and pray always that you be counted to worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. But he's talking about watching world events and praying for divine protection, not spending your life savings on a bunker or hoarding food or hoarding ammunition or building your own army or taking things into your own hands. This is a specific prophecy here in Luke about that. He said God will protect those who repent and turn to him. But that is the key. You have to turn to God and not have faith in yourself.
Right. I whenever I hear stories like this, I always have a certain amount of, I guess, sympathy for those who are doing this, simply because when you're looking at what's happening in the world, you have to acknowledge, if your eyes are open, just how dangerous circumstances are becoming. And it seems like the far more common problem is just heedlessly considering that everything is going to continue as it always has been, and really not paying attention to what's going on in the world, rather getting hung up in distractions of every type. When people are really watching, it is motivating them to take these kinds of steps. But as you said, if we're really involving God in our decision making and we're following the way that he talks about it in the Bible, we're going to take a different course. But this definitely is something that everyone should be paying close attention, and we do need to be watching and praying, and you do need to definitely involve God in your planning and make sure that you are ready as these events come to pass. If you want more information about that, I would encourage you to read chapter 4 of our booklet, Why Natural Disasters. The title of that is Are You Ready for the End of the World? And it gives some biblical perspective about that. You can also read our article up on thetrumpet.com right now by Jack Wood. It's been a while since we heard from Jack. Billionaires Prepping for the End of the World. And it'll give you more information about this very interesting subject. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for those links I just mentioned and those to all the other articles in the literature that we talked about on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Great to be here.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk, Gino Chi, and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Charles Peguy. It will never be known what acts of cowardice have been motivated by the fear of not looking sufficiently progressive. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.